Accession number 6024, Reel 5.
Mr. Humphrey, Reel 5. I want to move on to the subject of health now, which is very directly related to the subject which we've just finished talking about, namely food, because I imagine that some of the most serious of the health problems were derived from an insufficiency of food, either in quantity or quality.
Yes, certainly towards the end. In the earlier days, I think the main health problems arose from malaria and dysentery. I mean, malaria, of course, there was a lot of malarial mosquitoes in that part of the world, and within a few months of the Japanese occupation, I mean, most anti-malarial precautions which public authorities took, for example, the oiling of drains and all that sort of thing, come to a standstill. So malaria was widespread, and we had no drugs whatever for treating it. I mean, in those days, some people used to take prophylactic quinine, and the more modern drugs, atabrine and all, were only just coming in. But anyhow, we had none of them, any of them. So if you got malaria, well, you did or didn't recover. Most people did, of course. In many of its forms, most people had several attacks. The first attack was always the worst of benign tertiary malaria. Subsequent attacks tend to get less and less severe because your body acquires, I suppose, a natural immunity. In fact, I think most of the indigenous population of Borneo, the Borneo area, have got a natural immunity against malaria, which doesn't mean they don't get it, but they get it in a mild form, doesn't severely affect them. But one or two people did die of it. I mean, one man I remember who got it in what's called cerebral form, which is nearly always fatal. Dysentery was the other one, which is, of course, commonly believed to be, so to speak, a filth disease arriving from eating food which has been contaminated with bacteria, generally from ordure of some sort or another, which it shouldn't be, and that can spread very quickly. And dysentery is a terribly weakening disease. Well, I think cholera is an acute form of dysentery in a sense. I'm not too sure about that. Anyhow, it's a disease which involves you in most violent attacks of diarrhea, where you, if it's getting severe, can literally mean you're going to the lavatory every half hour, at least day and night. And of course that goes on for very long. It's tremendously debilitating, and in those conditions very, very difficult to recover. Those were the two worst things in the earlier, well, throughout. The other thing was the fact that scratches, cuts, or anything of that sort tended to go septic. Or I think I could almost say all men in the camp at some time or another had these leg ulcers, which were due. Worst things in the earlier, well, throughout. The other thing was the fact that scratches, cuts, or anything of that sort tended to go septic. And most men, or I think I could almost say all men in the camp at some time or another had these leg ulcers, which were due to skin on your legs being punctured at some time or another. The surface refusing to heal, and the failure of one's skin to heal, I believe, is due to largely to a vitamin deficiency. And some of these ulcers got really quite severe and very deep and foul. Towards the end, the more obvious illnesses associated with gross dietary imbalance or deficiency became more apparent, notably edema and beriberi, which are direct deficiency conditions, I think it's true to say, rather than illnesses. I mean, I don't think edema is due to a bug at all. It's a mechanical thing which results from kidney failure. But I don't think there's any virus or bacteria there, unlike malaria, which is of course mosquito carried, or dysentery, which is usually fly carried, or again carried by rats, mice, and all that sort of thing. But those were the main trouble things. One or two men had illnesses, I suppose, which they might have got anywhere. I remember certainly one man died of cancer, which he had a very agonising death because there were no drugs to relieve him. But I suppose he might have had that if he'd been free. And equally well, it's probably only fair to say there's certainly one case in my knowledge of a man who regarded himself as having been kept alive through having been in the camp so long. He had been an extremely heavy drinker, getting through a bottle of liquor a day before the Japs caught him. He was then forced onto the bandwagon, onto the teetotal wagon for 3.5 years. And at the end of it, he said, well, thank God for that, I'm still alive. And I'd have been dead if the Japs hadn't come in. But that was not a usual case.
Did the camp set up any sort of hospital or medical centre?
Internally, yes, we had, if my recollection is, we had a half or a third or some area of one hut where really serious cases, so to speak, could be put. But it wasn't used in any sense as an isolation camp. And men suffering from malaria or dysentery or anything just stayed in their beds and got over it or didn't.
What kind of facilities for what kind of treatment were there in this part of the hut that was set aside?
Well, I think really virtually nothing. I think it's true to say that just now and again, doctors in the camp were able to screw out of Yamamoto, who was the Japanese Army medical officer who's supposed to be in charge, I believe, of the whole area. I don't think it was only our camps. I think he also covered Kuching generally. I believe they occasionally screwed out of him an odd something or another, but it was always ludicrously inadequate, just like the six eggs for a camp, just on that sort of scale. Virtually there was nothing, but all that they could do was to try and relieve things. I mean, and they gave us very good advice. I mean, for example, these leg ulcers, the only way to do anything with them was to get any bit of rag or cloth and put salt and water on them, keep them open, and because the salt and water acts as, to some extent, as a disinfectant. It was the only thing you could, you know. They took, I mean, most men had them when we left the camp. I mean, they were virtually uncurable unless you could had food which allowed your skin to grow again, to heal, you see. And our dietary conditions certainly didn't allow that.
Was there a high death rate in the camp?
Not in our... Well, it depends what you mean by high. I've forgotten how many men died in our camp. In the Kuching camps as a whole, I believe the figure was about 500. I suppose that's out of, what, 3,000, 4,000, something like that. But most of those, the serious incidents of that, was in the soldiers' camp, I'm afraid. Because, as I say, these poor young men had no experience of life in the tropics, and many of them did not know the simple rules of preventing or minimizing illness.
As far as your camp was concerned, amongst those deaths which did occur, what was the most common cause?
I should think dysentery, really. I would think so. Dysentery is such a wasting disease, you see, which normally I think a man would, a man in good health like you and I are now, I mean, would not be unduly, well, certainly with drugs you wouldn't be unduly bothered with it at all, but even without drugs you'd recover if you were normally fit. I mean, your system would... you'd probably lose a stone or two, and that's about that. But eventually you'd correct yourself, and the bug would be excreted completely, and that's that. But the cure for dysentery was, in those conditions, was ghastly. It really meant starving. You see, with men who were already starving, because the only way of stopping acute diarrhea of that form is to go onto a non-solid diet completely, and even, but to drink as much as you can without vomiting. It was the only thing you could do. And but that meant, of course, that you rapidly got very weak. I think, I don't know what the doctors certified or would have said the actual cause of death was, because once a man gets terribly weak, or any sort of things can be the final killer, can't they? Mm. I mean, you know, heart failure, anything you like. I don't know. But I would have said, certainly dysentery gave me more trouble than anything else, and I think it was true of most of us. I mean, I always felt I had malaria several times there, but apart from the first time, I just felt thoroughly rotten for the best part of a week, and that was all. I mean, you know, high temperatures and that sort of thing. But the first time, it is very, very bad if you've never had it before, and if you're not in a physically fit state.
Did these problems of lack of food, health difficulties of one kind or another, did they affect morale on the camp?
Oh, I think they did, yes. It's very hard to say what affected morale. Clearly, the most severe effect on morale was the lack of any certainty of the end of the tunnel. I mean, where was the end of the tunnel? This was the $64,000 question, which was in everybody's mind almost the whole time. I mean, you couldn't see the end of the road. I mean, I think people can put up with an awful lot if they know when it's going to end. But when you can't see whether it's going to end, or indeed whether you're going to survive to the end, morale gets very much, tends to collapse. So I think the thing that kept most people reasonably sane was a determination to have interests and to think of things other than when are we going to get out, you know, and that sort of thing. Once you let your mind continually dwell on that, I mean, it's a stupid state to get into. The thing to do is to learn something, take an interest in something. I mean, try to put the time to good use, if you possibly could, so that you felt your life wasn't just being wasted. Mm.
Did the question of morale then vary quite a lot between one internee and another?
Oh, yes, I think so. Quite a lot. I think on the whole, as one would expect, some of the older men suffered more than I was a young man then. Suffered more than we did. I mean, most of them, I was, thank heavens, not married, but men that had the additional burden and thoughts on their minds of their wives and their children, older men who were perhaps in their late 40s, early 50s and that sort of thing, who began to wonder if they would ever come through, you know, and if they did, how much life was left. With some men, the prospects of whether they would be compulsorily retired when they got out on grounds of health, unfit for further tropical work and all that sort of thing. I think those things affected older men more. It's hard to say, but certainly you couldn't judge from your knowledge of a man, I think, as he was before he was interned, whether he was a good bet for high morale survivor or not.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, some men who were 100% robust, you know, tough characters, what you might call rugger playing types, who looked 100% fit. Sometimes one or two of those seemed to collapse in a year, you know, they couldn't adjust their mental attitudes to it. Whereas, on the other hand, some weedy fellow who you thought would collapse if the wind blew, came out just the same as when you went in, or very nearly. I mean, I think that whether or not your morale collapsed was, 75% mental attitude. Of course, I mean, if you had a violent physical illness, like cerebral malaria, or if you had some particular worry on your mind, it could aggravate it. But I think that would be broadly true. I think it would be true to your mental... Well, your view's as good as mine. I think it is towards illness now, don't you? If you're taken ill, I mean, some men will recover much more quickly than others, depending on their own outlook towards their illness. Mm. I think most doctors would think that.
Are you able to identify any other factors which influenced morale, apart from mentioned so far, which have been no light at the end of the tunnel, diet, food problems? Were there any other factors which got people down?
Well, I mentioned worry about their families.
Yes.
Well, those that had families, I'm sure, was a terrible headache. I think those were the main things.
What about things within the camp?
You mean disputes or anything of that sort?
Fights, well, I was thinking of lack of food, for example.
Oh, well, lack of... Yes, I mean, well, that's a...
An obvious one.
I don't know if I would necessarily say that so much affect morale. I mean, that affected health. Well, of course, it affected morale in the sense that standards of conduct tended to collapse when things got very bad. I mean, collapse is too strong a word. But, I mean... As things got worse and worse and worse, the attitude of some people, and I think probably is true to say of all of us to some extent, became increasingly sauve-qui-peut. In other words, the idea of keeping the community alive as a community with the maximum number surviving tended more and more as things got worse towards a mental attitude, well, nobody else is going to look after me except me. And if I'm going to come through this alive, I've got to put me first. Well, if that sort of attitude got too strong, I mean, clearly it did result in, well, I would call it not so much a collapse of morale as a collapse of standards of conduct, you know, of good neighbourliness, of reasonable outlook towards your fellow internees. I don't want to exaggerate that at all, because I think on the whole, certainly our civilian camp, I think, came through it pretty well. I mean, I don't know many men who feel bitter towards others about things that happened in the camp. There must be one or two, but I don't think many. I certainly don't.
Did overcrowding in your billets affect morale, do you think?
I don't think there was gross overcrowding. I mean, each man had enough space for a bed. I mean, 6 by 3.5 or whatever it might have been. I mean, there were gaps between the huts. See, in that climate, provided it's actually not raining or thundering, anything of that sort, which of course it does quite a bit, it's a very heavy rainfall, you could always go outside the hut and move around in the areas which were common to all the huts, between the huts or this sort of open green and that sort of thing. Well, it wasn't a green, open padang was the word for it, but it wasn't a green. No, I wasn't unduly conscious of overcrowding there. I was a bit in the conditions that they were in Jesselton, but that was only for a short period. But in Kuching, I don't think one could say that we were grossly overcrowded. We were grossly undernourished and undersupplied with the essentials of life, but that's a different point.
Were you also grossly overworked in relation to your physical condition?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Did that have a bearing on morale, do you think?
Oh, yes. Yes. I mean, it meant, again, that some people, well, most people sometimes tried to evade heavy work because they realised that the food wouldn't sustain it. In other words, you did tend to sacrifice yourself if you did work calling for unnecessary expenditure of energy. Because, I mean, after all, intake and calorie output, I think, are closely related. And if the intake's inadequate, the more calorie output you have in terms of physical energy, I mean, digging, hacking, heaving, or whatever your job might have been, the worse for you.
Staying with this question of morale, how did the Dutch fare in this respect by comparison with the British?
Well, my impression is, I don't know whether I'm being unfair, my impression was that they were always having unholy rows, but it was amongst themselves and we kept up for the most part. But they had a much wider spectrum of behaviour. They had some men whom I think were absolutely splendid, and men whom I would have admired, or whatever their race or anything else. Equally well, they had some men whom I would never have had any use for in any life that I happened to be in, I think. In other words, in their colonial empire, they had a broader spectrum of European Dutch than we had in our colonial empire. I mean, we, by and large, I'm excluding now, of course, the British soldiers in that camp, but we, by and large, were what you would call the managerial administrator class. We were the middle class of England, of the United Kingdom, or of Australia or what have you. The Dutch, on the other hand, seemed to have a whole lot of people of, well, so they're right across the spectrum, you know, working class people, this sort of thing. On the whole, I think the Dutch civil service were absolutely first class, what I call their Leiden-trained men who'd been through their Leiden university. They're splendid men. Most of their commercial people that I got to know at all, their bankers, people in shipping, that sort of thing, seemed pretty good. But there was a group of nondescript people whom I could never quite place what they were, who, well, at times gave me the impression of being just thoroughly non-cooperative and a bit bloody-minded. But it's not, I didn't have to bother with them. I mean, they didn't, there were no, what I might call, Anglo-Dutch showdowns, except perhaps at the bridge table. We used to organise international matches at bridge and that sort of thing. When, again, there were always, there could be very violent disputes about the ethics of bridge.
Yes. I suppose as a result of this similarity of backgrounds, educations and things like that, that one found amongst the British internees at Kuching, you would not get the divisiveness which might occur in a more mixed population.
I think it's fair to say that, yes. I think we were all, by and large, of what you might call the same class, you know. We spoke in the same way in general terms. Of course, there were odd people from the North Country with Yorkshire accents or what have you, but by and large, we all spoke the same sort of English. We were all united in our views about the war against Japan. We were all people who held, to some extent, responsible positions in civil life, and therefore perhaps had a little of the responsibility towards the rest of the community that goes with responsibility generally, you know. I mean, I don't want to appear to be, how can I put it, exaggerating this, but I think it made a difference, the fact that we were all more or less from the same social class stratum in the United Kingdom. It helped.
That removes social factors as a criterion by which individuals within the camp might have grouped with other individuals. But for all that, presumably grouping did take place nonetheless. People set up their own little groups, the people they got on with best. What kind of criteria did apply in the creation of like-minded groups, if you like?
It's very hard to say. There was a tendency, to some extent, for the groups to be geographical, in the sense that some men knew each other before they got in there, you see. I mean, people who worked together for several years in Sarawak probably knew each other, so naturally they tended automatically to form a group. Similarly, in North Borneo, Brunei, or even within those countries, because those countries are very large indeed, much larger than people. There were people that came from the same geographical, where they all knew each other. They had all belonged to the same little local club, probably played tennis together and that sort of thing, you see. Well, naturally, they tended to form a group. I think it was as simple as that, really. I don't think people formed themselves into groups on the basis of, of anything else, except when it got perhaps to these talks and lectures and those sorts of things that we organised. Then you might belong to a group learning Chinese, but you mightn't see the other fellows in that group much at all, except when you're doing your hour in the evening, having Chinese instruction from the Chinese Consul General in Borneo. I think that's probably how it was. I mean, the group I happened to be in my hut, there were four or five of us who were pretty close. One of them is my very dear old friend, Philip Rogers, who's now in his 80s, lives near Guildford, and who was an agricultural expert. There's another in the constant bridge four I had, a remarkable man called Charky Taylor, who had a glass eye. I never really discovered why. But he was a self-enterprise man who did shark fishing off North Borneo, catching and selling sharks, you know, for shark skins, shark oil, and all the rest of it. Another one was a rather remarkable character called Basil Brewer, who was a very good bridge player, but he was the manager of a rubber estate in Borneo. Well, I played more bridge with those three than I ever shall with any other three in the world, I think.
We spoke earlier in the interview about the size of the camp at Kuching, and I think there's a correction you want to make about that.
Yes, there is. I've had an opportunity in the meanwhile to look at some notes and other documentary things that I happen to have, and the actual numbers in the male civilian camp were nothing like the figure of, I think, around 800, which I had in mind and had worked out by quick arithmetic. They were, in fact, 247, all told, at a date which I can't specify, but it was a date which certainly included the numbers brought there from North Borneo. And it also included the Dutch, who I think were about 60 of that number. It also included five or six Americans who had escaped from Manila in the Philippines in a launch and arrived eventually in Kuching after quite a lot of adventures. Included amongst those was a man whose name I remember. His name was Colley, who was vice president of the Bechtel Company, which built all the Liberty ships in the war. He was quite an important person, but he was, of course, there for the rest of the war. There was also, curiously, one Dane who kept making attempts through the Japanese authorities to get himself released on the very reasonable grounds that Denmark was not at war with Japan. But he never made it, and he was stuck in the camp for the duration. He survived, but he never got free. So I would like to make that correction on numbers, because otherwise the statement I made would be most misleading. Of that number, 25 died, most of whom I think are buried in the cemetery, which was within the camp perimeter. But in that cemetery, again from records I've been able to look at more recently, the Sarawak authorities said there were roughly 700 buried, so the remainder must have been from the military sections of the camp as a whole, which included the British and I think a few Australian other ranks, and their officers who had been segregated from them and placed in a camp which was not contiguous with theirs but was within the whole surrounding perimeter.
So that makes three component parts at Kuching, and there was a fourth?
Really four, yes. Male civilians, women and children, British other ranks, or military other ranks, and officers, military officers.
Now, how frequent was the contact between these different parts of the Kuching complex?
Well, as between the male civilians and the women and children, quite occasional, but always under very strict supervision.
What sort of circumstances would it be under?
Well, the Emperor's birthday was regarded as a special treat for everybody. Christmas Day, they allowed things. Occasionally, if they were in the right sort of mood, a man might be allowed to go and see his wife on the grounds that it was her birthday or something. But by and large, they didn't like these contacts at all, and any attempts at waving to the women and children, even though you could see them across the wire, was prohibited.
Now, on a festive occasion like Christmas or the Emperor's birthday, what form would the get-togethers take?
Oh, well, the Japanese issued orders required us to lay on a concert and various things. In other words, one had to do all the window dressing of celebrating. And they occasionally put in a little bit of extra rations or something, anything to make it look as though they were doing a lot.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, of the four Japanese officers whose names I remember and whom we saw most of, their names were Suga, Nakata, Takino, and Yamamoto. Takino was subsequently prosecuted and sentenced to death by war crimes on the grounds that he was withholding food from our camp, which was available.
Mm.
So was Yamamoto. He was convicted.
Can we stay with the contact with with the women and children's camp? So this would be what, three or four times a year, something of that order, or more often?
Perhaps half a dozen times a year. Naturally, it didn't so closely concern me. I was not married, and I had no wife and no children in that section of the camp. But I would think they saw each other perhaps... were allowed to communicate with each other perhaps half a dozen times a year. I mean, averaged over the years. And they were allowed to... At least our camp as a whole was allowed to assist the women and children's camp by, for example, carrying in firewood, which we felled and carried in, which they needed for their cookhouse, and making wooden shoes for children in the camp who had otherwise been barefoot. And, of course, barefoot in that climate's not very sensible if you can avoid it.
This would make for fairly regular contact then, especially as far as chopping their wood is concerned.
Oh, it didn't chop. The wood was chopped outside. It was only could only be carried in. But it didn't amount to a contact with them.
I see.
It merely meant the working party went in, dumped the wood, and went out under guard. Mm.
Presumably there were single women in this camp as well as married women.
Must have been few. Mm.
I wondered on those rare meetings, these rare contacts, whether this provided any opportunities for amours by the single men from your camp.
Oh, no. Well, perhaps I was rather naive in those days, but I'm pretty sure the answer to that is no. I don't think that would have been tolerated either by the Japs or by us or by the women. I mean, it wasn't the sort of thing that went on so much in those days, you know. Times have changed.
I can't believe you didn't have flirtations.
But I thought you meant rather more than that. But no, I don't think there was anything of that sort. We didn't have all that number of, so to speak, young men. There weren't very many men in our camp under the age of 26 or 27. I mean, there weren't sort of no teenagers or anything like that.